Great. Thank you for the really warm welcome. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to make it yesterday. We had our UK national lymphoma meeting over the last 2 days, so we've had a really chaotic couple of days, not chaotic, but busy couple of days. And I'm really keen for us to try and do better in terms of fostering interaction between the group in the UK and the group in Ireland in terms of delivery of the research agenda in lymphoma. So it'd be good if we can kind of open up more some of those discussions. So I'm going to talk about the changing landscape of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and of course there's a lot to capture over the next 40 minutes or so, and I hope to try and telescope us a little bit into the future as to what perhaps we might expect to happen. Before I begin, I've got a number of conflicts of interest. I do a lot of work with partners in industry, and so I've got a number of conflicts of interest to declare. So our expectation of success in large cell lymphoma is high. If you look at the outcomes from the last big randomized phase III study we did in the UK, over 1,000 patients, we can see that over 80% of patients are alive 2 to 3 years from diagnosis. But of course, we recognize that the patients who get into clinical trials are not always representative of the patients that we see in our everyday practice. We know that trials patients are younger, they have a lower burden of comorbidity, and just the kinetics of their disease is different. So we recognize those patients with rapid disease kinetics, where you just want to get on the treatment, makes that much more difficult to recruit them into trials. So when you look at population-based analysis, and this is data in the lower curve from Yorkshire and Humberside, we recognize that only about 60% of patients are alive 2 to 3 years from diagnosis. So we've got a lot of work to do. Now, we're quite good at predicting which patients are going to do well and which patients are going to do less well. Those patients, we can predict through the simple parameters of the IPI, recognizing that those patients with a low number of IPI risk factors will have excellent outcomes, perhaps survival of over 95%. But those patients with multiple clinical risk factors, which should just trip off your tongue just for the registrars, their overall survival may be about 50% in real-world patient populations. And then on top of those clinical variables, we can layer on information about the biology. And this is an evolving story, but we've recognized for probably the last, 15 years or so that there is heterogeneity in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and that those patients with an ABC phenotype have a worse prognosis than those patients with a GCB phenotype. But actually, what we're recognizing within those groups is there's a diversity of outcomes. However, I do think that we are very much behind some of our colleagues in the other fields of hematological oncology in terms of the application of biological risk determination and different approaches according to the biology of the disease. And we can layer on information about the oncogenic aberrations that we've heard earlier this morning in terms of FISH, MYC, and BCL2 rearrangements. And really, what's come to pass over the last years is actually that if we take together information about cytomorphology, immunohistochemistry, FISH analysis, clonality assessment, we recognize that we've got a diversity and a large number of large cell lymphomas. In fact, under the current classifications, I think it's like 17 different types of large cell lymphomas, of which the majority are going to be diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, NLS. That's probably about 70% of those. And with the application of new technologies such as NGS panels and whole exome and whole genome sequencing, along with the application of ctDNA, which I'm sure Serpa will have told you about a lot about yesterday, we can recognize the heterogeneity and the diversity, and we can start to use these tools to help subdivide the DLBCLs much further and perhaps use these as a tools for biomarkers and dynamic risk assessments. Now, what we recognize in large cell lymphoma is that there's a great degree of different genomic aberrations that have been identified, and perhaps there's many more than perhaps we might see in some of the solid tumors. But when we look at these driver mutations and we look at these recurrent driver mutations, we can probably group them into a number of sort of functional classes in terms of what perhaps are recurrently mutated. So we see epigenetic dysregulation as being a key feature of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which may or may not be potentially targetable. We see mutations in multiple signaling pathways, particularly those involved in the NF-kappa-B pathway, and we recognize that clearly we've got applications for this as a target for therapeutics. And also we recognize that there are clearly defects in immune recognition and antigen presentation. And I think this is really interesting as we think about how we might target different subclasses of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in the future. However, what are we doing today? Well, actually, you know, we're not really applying NGS panels. I'm not really applying lots of molecular diagnostics in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma management. You know, we can use the MyD88 to help us recognize types of large cell lymphomas that are perhaps associated with immune privileged sites. And we recognize, and we've known this for a long time, that those patients with a TP53 aberration in large cell lymphoma have a much worse prognosis. But really, we've lacked the tools to date to be able to do anything about that. I think we really need to think about how we may apply this kind of genomic information. So we're not really looking, are we, at single gene defects in large cell lymphoma. As you've heard earlier this morning, however, what is really key is the timely delivery of FISH analysis. And I think, you know, we really have to make sure that our systems are set up so that we can use the determination of MYC and BCL2 status in a clinically meaningful timeframe so that we can make choices about how we select patients for perhaps intensified strategies. Because we recognize that those patients who do have MYC and BCL2 aberrations under the high-grade B-cell lymphoma group have a worse prognosis, and that's particularly within the first 2 years. So timely delivery of FISH is really very important. And I know that there are complexities around how we now classify high-grade B-cell lymphomas with FISH aberrations, but I think that that's really something for a further discussion. Of course, we're thinking now about how we might use this very powerful tool of ctDNA, how we might use this to baseline provide a genetic profile of the tumor, how we might use this in dynamic risk assessment, and how we may use this as a marker of MRD as end of treatment. And I think some exciting information about how we might use this to identify patients who are higher risk of CNS disease. But ctDNA technology is not one single technology. It's not like looking at what the serum potassium is. What you read into this and what I read into this may be very different. And I think there's a lot of work to be done in terms of bringing together methodologies, standardized calling pipelines, and really the quality assurance around this, and making this much more accessible. Because we know that although in the US there's a commercially available assay, the cost of that is prohibitive. And when we think about the application of ctDNA in our academic institutions, we need to think about how we might be able to deliver this. But I think what's very clear is that if we're looking for new biomarkers of outcome, I think ctDNA is really a very powerful tool. This is data that's just about to be published in the JCO from our study in the UK, the DIRECT study, which was led by Dan Hobson from Cambridge, recognizing that the burden of ctDNA at baseline is really important in terms of predicting outcome. Those with the highest burdens have the worst outcome. And I think that's relevant as we might think about moving this forward in terms of a tool for risk stratification. And not only can we think about ctDNA as a tool for stratification at baseline, but we can also think about the PET scan. The total metabolic tumor volume, again, is a really powerful tool in predicting outcomes. The burden of the disease in a patient A who has a total metabolic tumor volume of perhaps 4 liters represents a distinct outcome from the patient in panel B who has a total metabolic tumor volume of somewhere like 200 mils, who has a much better prognosis. And whilst we can think about the PET scan, the utility of this information at baseline, we can start to introduce that into some of the clinical risk parameters. And clearly, if you take in the total metabolic tumor volume, you can add to the fidelity of the IPI in determining these low and high risk groups of patients. Now, Of course, I don't know how easy it is and how engaged your PET radiologists are in reporting total metabolic tumor volume. We found that really quite hard outside of clinical trials in terms of the application of this. I hope that the enhanced AI software will make this much more clinically available for us and patients. But we're going to use this as a tool for stratification in our next frontline study in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And the PET doctors have really grasp this problem in terms of risk stratification, in terms of using the PET scan as a tool. And I think that we can see that there are multiple different radiomic variables that are being assessed by researchers in PET, measures of diversity, measures of relatedness, and measures of the volumes of the tumor. And all of very many of these are shown to be important prognostically in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So I think the PET scan has got greater potential in terms of application of defining high-risk patients, and actually there are new tracers coming on which may enhance that quality of the biomarker. What about the interim PET scan? Now, I used to spend a lot of time talking about interim PET scans and saying that the interim PET scans are probably not what you should do, but I think perhaps our tools are changing, and we recognize that there is value in the interim PET scan in terms of the fact that those patients who have a positive interim PET scan, clearly that's associated with an inferior progression-free survival and overall survival. But the performance of this in terms of predicting outcomes is really very variable. And we can see this across multiple studies. So not every positive interim PET scan is associated with poor prognosis. Not every positive interim PET scan needs that you do to change things. What we do recognize is that the negative predictive value of a negative interim PET scan is really high. And that's great. That's a nice conversation to be had with patients. And there may be some discussion about whether that might be a tool that you can use in combination with ctDNA in terms of future trials to de-escalate patients. So what can we do about a positive interim PET scan? Well, unfortunately, with the tools that we've had to date, we've not been able to change that adverse phenotype associated with a positive interim PET scan. You know, two trials here looking at intensification of chemotherapy in those patients who have a positive interim PET scan. We recognize that intensification hasn't changed the outcomes for the patient. However, we do have new tools now that are not based upon chemotherapy in terms of therapeutic intervention. And I think the door is now wider open for this early identification of high-risk patients and going to do something about that. Now, I'm not going to spend time today talking about early-stage diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We recognize that we can achieve very good outcomes in some patients who have a very low-risk disease. There are patients with early-stage disease who do have adverse risk features where the outcomes remain suboptimal, but I think that there's still work to be done around the edges for these patients. But for those patients who have limited risk, this is just data from the FLIER study, which has got recruited patients with an IPI of zero, they have really excellent outcomes. For those patients, however, who have higher IPI scores, we've tried over the last couple of decades really high, really hard to improve on the outcomes of R-CHOP chemotherapy. You would have been to talks where people have talked about adding additional chemotherapy agents, intensification of therapies, consolidation with high-dose chemotherapy and various maintenance strategies, and adding biologically targeted agents. And I think, whilst tens of thousands of patients have gone into clinical trials of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, I think we can start to say now that we're really beginning to change the dial at last. And the solutions haven't come from chemotherapy. The solutions have come from better understanding. And there's really two schools of thought as to how you may improve the outcomes in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And one of those is to take a strategy based upon patient individualized understanding of the biological phenotype of the individual patient. You can look at the pattern of genomic aberrations. You can look at the pattern of disruption of various biological pathways, and you can try and match a small molecule to an individual patient's biological requirements. The other approach is to take an agnostic approach, where we say, look, let's look at ubiquitously expressed cell surface antigens, and let's try and enhance our therapeutics. And perhaps we've seen outcomes that are being improved from the fact that we've got antibodies with benefits. We've got antibodies that seem to work better, such as antibody drug conjugates, and we've got the same targets, but actually what we're trying to use is we're employing the targets and we are saying, let's use therapies that recruit T cells, let's affect T cell expansion, and let's see if that improves outcomes. So first of all, the agnostic approach. I call it the agnostic approach, but it probably isn't. And as we begin to understand this a little bit more, we recognize that there is some difference in terms of the biology of the disease. Perhaps, obviously, the marker of success has been the polatuzumab, antibody drug conjugate targeting CD79B, pretty much ubiquitously expressed on B-cell lymphomas. We recognize that polatuzumab as a single agent or added with rituximab has some utility, but has relatively low complete metabolic response rates. Whilst if we start to add this to chemotherapy, we know that we can enhance activity. So in combination with bendamustine and rituximab, we see a doubling of the complete metabolic response rate, and we see a sort of three times as long duration of benefit. But of course, you know, in the first line setting, this is where we have seen sort of the application, and in very many territories, sort of the running away of the use of polatuzumab with R-CHOP chemotherapy. The POLARIX study demonstrated an absolute improvement in progression-free survival of 6.5% at 2 years, and a 27% reduction in the risk of progression or death, and that has been maintained with the five-year follow-up data. And in the UK, this was approved by NICE, and absolutely has seen a complete sea change in our delivery. And when we look at the delivery in the real world, we're seeing that probably 65% of our patients are receiving polatuzumab with R-CHOP chemotherapy in the frontline setting. Where we don't use this is patients who've got a low IPI, so 0 to 1, and those patients who are older. We have a sort of cutoff at the age of 80 because the data is not mature enough from the Polar Bear study, and so we don't know about the efficacy in the older patient population. And of course, it's always good to know how things are shaping out. The Germans did a comparison of using Polar R-CHOP with one of their intensified regimens, including etoposide, and they say that this looks like it's enhancing the benefit and perhaps provides an alternative to using etoposide. And in the real world, data from China, this is a big study of over 600 patients, tells us that the performance of Polar R-CHOP in the real world is near identical to the performance that's been seen in the pivotal clinical trials. However, this is not perhaps a truly agnostic tool. And if we look at the analysis according to the biology of the disease, we can see that those patients with an ABC phenotype appear to benefit compared with those patients with a GCB phenotype. And there's a lot of discussion going on in the real world about whether you should be selecting according to the phenotype of the disease. Now, what's important about this is a selection based not upon your immunohistochemical surrogates, it's based upon transcriptional profiling. And I think that it's quite difficult because we recognize that there is a disconnect between the readouts for immunohistochemistry and from transcriptional profiling. So I think selecting based on IHC who receives Polar R-CHOP is perhaps a little bit of a minefield. But anyway, so that's one sort of application of an agnostic approach. Perhaps the use of CAR T cells earlier in the disease process, where you've got fitter T cells, you've got T cells that are much more likely to expand. Perhaps this might be a way to overcome some of those risk factors, be they biological or they be clinical risk factors. The ZUMA 12 study took patients who were considered to be high risk in the first line setting based upon two parameters. One of those was a baseline based upon the IPI score, or the presence of double hit disease. And the second step was that these patients had a positive interim PET scan after they had two cycles of induction therapy. And the expectation of these was that these patients would have a poor outcome. But actually, those patients who fulfilled those two criteria, if they then went on to receive axicabtagene, this is a small scale trial performed in North America, the outcomes in terms of response rates and progression-free and overall survival was much better than what we expected from a historical control. So now, prospectively, we're evaluating the role of CAR T-cell therapy in a randomized study in those patients with an IPI score of 4 or 5, B between conventional immunochemotherapy and upfront CAR T-cell therapy. I think it's a great shame that study missed out on an opportunity to think about some of these biological risk factors, and it's just restricted itself to those patients with an IPI score of 4 to 5. So CAR T cells, but we recognize actually that there's a differential effect with CAR T cells according to the characteristics of the tumor. And we might recognize that some of the important microenvironmental factors may be influencing them. So it may not necessarily be a truly agnostic approach. And then, of course, there's lots of excitement about the application of bispecific antibodies in the first line setting and how that may potentially improve upon the outcomes of conventional R-CHOP chemotherapy. And again, the approach with bispecific has been simply to give this to everybody and let's work out the problem who clearly benefits sort of retrospectively. So I think there's a lot of work to do to understand with the bispecifics which potential subgroups may benefit. I think we've kind of been a little bit vexed about the environment of giving a bispecific with R-CHOP chemotherapy, where you're giving T-cell oppressive effects of cyclophosphamide and you're giving a shedload of steroids to patients. But this is now also being evaluated in a number of randomized studies. And so we'll wait and see what happens. So let's flip the coin, okay? So we've thought about agnostic ways targeting cell surface associated antigens. What about taking a more targeted approach? And why don't we think about how we might impact some of these dysregulated pathways that we have talked about in large cell lymphoma? And you know, there's been a cluster over the last few years of trials where we've added drugs that we thought had activity in ABC, DLBCL in the relapse setting to R-CHOP chemotherapy in the hope of improving outcomes. And we've seen that that's been a series of negative trials. One of those was the Phoenix trial that looked at adding ibrutinib to R-CHOP chemotherapy in those patients who had a non-GC phenotype, so the immunohistochemical equivalent of the ABC subgroup. And you know that actually the outcome was that the event-free survival, the primary endpoint of the study, was identical. And in fact, actually, it was detrimental for patients who were older to receive ibrutinib because, of course, it compromised the amount of dose intensity for the R-CHOP chemotherapy. But actually, since these studies, we've recognized that there's a greater degree of diversity in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is not simply two distinct diseases. It's not a transcriptionally profiled dichotomous ABC and GCB. But actually, if we think about the pattern of genomic aberration, copy number variants, etc., we can recognize that there are different biological subgroups. And these biological subgroups share potential oncogenic vulnerabilities that we may potentially target and may have difference in terms of prognosis. It's not at all this way of doing it to determine prognosis, but it's actually trying to group patients with a shared biology. And you can see that there's been a number of different approaches to this. The group in Boston presented the sort of cluster and then the refinement of that that's been recently published in the way of prospectively assessing this under the DLB class. And then the group from the National Cancer Institute recognizing that there are probably 7 different biological categories of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. The challenge with the genomic classification is that although we can group patients with shared genomic vulnerabilities, actually there's a large group of patients, particularly with the NCI classification, that actually fall outside of one of these and who don't have one of these shared biologies. And in fact, 40% of patients, if you use the NCI classification, fall into this sort of other non-specified group. But in terms of a framework for thinking about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, thinking about some of these biological patterns, we're starting to think now about how we may be able to exploit this from a clinical perspective. So let's go back to the Phoenix study, negative study. But if you reanalyze this, understanding in fact that there's not one subgroup of ABC diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but perhaps there are at least 3 different types of ABC, each with different genomic characteristics and different biological characteristics, we can recognize that there are patients who benefit from the addition of a BTK inhibitor. So those patients in the MCD subgroup, you know, this is driven by constitutive activation of the B cell receptor, and those in the N1 subgroup clearly benefit from the addition of R-CHOP, of ibrutinib to R-CHOP chemotherapy, whilst actually their outcomes can be disappointing if they're treated with R-CHOP chemotherapy alone. Now, the way we've been thinking about this is to perhaps move this on to the next generation of BTK inhibitors. Acalabrutinib has much better kinase selectivity and therefore has many of the less off-target effects that we associate with ibrutinib, which may be contributing to some of the toxicity that we may see when we're adding a BTK inhibitor to R-CHOP chemotherapy. And we recognize that there are challenges around this because, of course, we know ibrutinib inhibits T-cell function that may have an impact upon the infection profile and perhaps platelet function as well. So in the UK, we've done a phase two study of adding acalabrutinib to R-CHOP chemotherapy. We saw excellent outcomes, as one would expect in this kind of phase two trial. And in the UK, we've just completed recruitment to the Remodel A study, which was a randomized study between those patients receiving R-CHOP chemotherapy and those patients receiving R-CHOP with acalabrutinib. And our study was an all-comers. We took an agnostic approach in terms of the cell of origin. There's been a commercial study that's been recruited by AstraZeneca, which just took patients who had a non-GC phenotype because of the belief that there was preferential activity. I will say to you that we have seen very clear activity of acalabrutinib with R-CHOP across all of the genomic subclasses. Now, just going back to this idea about genomic stratification, and let's go back to the analysis of the Polaric study, what we do recognize is that actually, you know, there is no such thing as an agnostic agent. And actually, if you think about the biology of the disease, we've recognized that the clear benefit from patients to receiving polatuzumab, although it targets CD79B, appears in those patients with the CD5 subclass. So the CD5, again, it's a near equivalent to the MCD subgroup. It's driven by B-cell receptor aberrations. And we've just seen this data, recognizing that not everybody benefits from what we think is an agnostic approach. Now, let's try and take this whole idea of molecular targeting one step forward. And the group in Shanghai have published the Guidance 01 study, which is a really interesting pilot, which they're now expanding into much bigger trials, to say, actually, can I try and identify prospectively which one of these my patients, which one of these genomic subgroups my patients belong to, and can I try and match a therapeutic targeted agent with a pattern of genomic vulnerabilities? So these are patients who are newly diagnosed and they receive one cycle of R-CHOP chemotherapy. And at the same time, they have a very limited genomic panel of just 20 genes, which is being delivered in real time. And it tries to fit them into one of five different biological subgroups. There's some good matching here in terms of the novel therapeutic, for example, the addition of ibrutinib to the MCD subgroup. Perhaps some of these are less good in terms of rationale. And this is a very small study. It's just 120 patients. But the principle is important. It's trying to say, prospectively, let's identify the pattern of genomic vulnerabilities. Then let's go on and see what the impact of that is across the whole outcomes for all patients. And what was very interesting is that those patients who had a targeted therapy based upon the pattern of biology added to R-CHOP chemotherapy had a better overall response rate and a complete remission rate than those patients simply receiving R-CHOP chemotherapy on its own. Now, the numbers in any one of these subgroups is really very small, but overall, this whole strategy of biologically matched genomic therapies with R-CHOP compared with R-CHOP on its own, significantly improved progression-free survival and overall survival. And this is now being sort of tested in trials of many thousands of patients. So the power of some of these rarer subgroups can be assessed. However, there are challenges. There are challenges of resistance of this approach. If you're going to target one particular pathway, then you're going to have challenges in terms of the resistance. And so this strategy of using a single drug probably is not going to work. Because if we look at the disease, we can see that there's very clear intratumoral heterogeneity. We recognize during the course of the disease, we see clonal evolution, and we see both spatial heterogeneity and longitudinal heterogeneity in terms of the patterns potentially of resistance. And this is very relevant because a tumor taken from one place or at one point in the disease may have a very different pattern of sensitivity to various targeted agents compared with another. And that's just looking at the tumor cells themselves. What about the very important impact of the tumor microenvironment in this very complex interaction in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma between the cells of the microenvironment and those cells that are the tumor cells themselves? And what we recognize is using various methods to profile the microenvironment that we can recognize distinct phenotypes with distinct different microenvironments that may potentially be targetable, but we may also have an impact upon prognosis. So the interaction between the tumor and the microenvironment and patterns of resistance are clearly very important. So when we think about understanding the biology of a tumor, actually probably what we need to do is do some complex multi-omic profiling rather than simply focusing on a genomic panel to identify the clear biology of the disease and therefore to target patients if we're going to take this stratified approach. Now, obviously one way of saying, well, you've got multiple resistance, you've got potential for resistance, you've got targeting one pathway is perhaps not the best way, is what about saying, let's take a combination approach. And let's see if we can use multiple targeted therapies in combination to see if we can improve outcome and potentially reduce toxicities. And the group at the MD Anderson have used this approach of a non-chemotherapy to look at a combination, the ultra regimen of lenalidomide, tafa, rituximab, and acalabrutinib, to perhaps overcome some of these challenges regarding resistance. And this is a very small scale study so far, but I think it's exciting. I didn't realize that we would ever get to a point of talking entirely about non-chemotherapy approaches in the frontline management of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. But the provisional data has demonstrated some really interesting reports for patients. So I think what I want to say is that there is a huge amount of potential for changes in the frontline approach to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. I think there are currently 14 randomized phase 3 large-scale trials ongoing looking at drugs that have shown efficacy in the relapse and refractory patient population, now in the frontline setting in combination or being compared against R-CHOP or polar R-CHIP chemotherapy. So I think watch this space because we're going to see a very different landscape in the future. The trouble with these trials is they are all-comer trials. And all that information I've just told you about the biology is not being encompassed in this. And I think it's so important that we do harness the information about the biology to improve the outcomes for our patient. Our academic approach in the UK now is that we are about to start the RADICAL study, which is incorporating some of that information about the biology of the disease at baseline, and for us to be able to select perhaps which one of these patients needs a novel therapeutic rather than those patients that might need all of these. And so we're assessing a number of factors at baselines, including the presence of P53 mutations, the burden of ctDNA at baseline, the total metabolic tumor volume, and actually the molecular high grade, this transcriptional profile of high risk patients, and we're identifying these as high risk patients. And if you're a non-high risk patient, then you all go sort of have standard care of polar R-CHIP. But if you're a high risk patient, we think you're most likely to benefit from the intervention. So in this study, we're adding a bispecific to R-CHOP chemotherapy. So really thinking about how we should target the use of some of these novel therapeutics. Now, what we don't know at the moment is whether all the same patients are going to be the patients who have TP53 aberrations, high ctDNA at baseline, high total metabolic tumor volume, or are they going to be a different group of patients? The other strategy that we're looking at is the exploration of the value of the end of treatment ctDNA. So looking at MRD positivity at the end of treatment. And we recognize that those patients who are ctDNA positive at the end of induction immunochemotherapy and who have achieved PET negativity, this group of patients appear to have a poor prognosis. And there's now a number of relatively small sample-sized studies that have demonstrated the value of end-of-treatment ctDNA. And so we are sort of working with the commercial sector in terms of identifying these groups of patients and then offering these patients in a randomized fashion CAR T-cell therapy to consolidate their response, given the very poor outcome of those patients who are positive. And then in the sort of third arm of our approach in terms of biological high-risk disease, this is a study that we're focusing on the elderly patients called the Bloom study, where what we're trying to do is doing genomic classification of patients in a prospective manner. And very much in a similar way to the guidance study is actually we're trying to match a therapeutic intervention with an approach to reduce the amount of mini R-CHOP chemotherapy we give older patients, because we recognize with older patients the delivery of R-mini-CHOP is troublesome, it's still very toxic, we often don't get there, and our outcomes are inferior. So we're asking the question about how we can match this, and so that's in the process of being set up. We've done the front end, we know that we can deliver genomic profiling in real time. We've got to see if we can make a difference, and I hope that this is a blueprint for how we may approach in the future the management of DLBCL. So that's where we are in the first line setting. What about in the relapse and refractory setting? So let me sort of help sort of illustrate where we are with the novel therapeutics by a case presentation. And this is a young man of ours who presented with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, who presented with disease in the peripheral blood, in the bone marrow, with testicular involvement and a significant burden of disease, a high Ki-67, no MYC rearrangement, but with extra copies of BCL2 and BCL6. And we induced him with the R-Codox-MR IVAC regimen, which we do in these patients who have the risk of sanctuary sites. And we know from our randomized phase 2 study in the UK that this is associated with a good outcome. And he remitted very quickly and achieved a complete metabolic response and was consolidated with radiotherapy to the testes. Now, unfortunately, less than 1 year later, he relapsed with disease and he relapsed with pleural involvement. And this demonstrated no change in the phenotype. It was a GC phenotype, again, with the same pattern of genomic aberrations. And we have recently published our guidelines in the UK. And I know that we've just also published in Hemosphere the European guidelines from EHA, which I think are a really nicely written set of guidelines. And I kind of want to use this case as really an illustration, some of the justification of the treatment algorithms for relapse and refractory disease. So first of all, there is still a place in the era of second-line CAR T-cell therapy for reinduction immunochemotherapy followed by high-dose chemotherapy. And I think we should be comfortable about this in those patients where we're not able to access second-line CAR T-cell therapy. This is data from the Spanish group looking at long-term outcomes from those patients who have had an autograft. And those patients who go into an autograft in CR, we see that 60% of these patients are progression-free at 6 years from their high-dose chemotherapy. The trouble is the tool that gets us to the CR has been inadequate, and the treatment of reinduction immunochemotherapy has been really very disappointing in those patients with the most refractory of disease and those patients who relapse early. So that's why we've seen such sort of broad spread adoption in the second line setting of CAR T cell therapy in those patients who are the early relapses, and unfortunately the majority of patients will relapse early after completion induction immunochemotherapy. Now, of course, it was natural to build upon the response that we've seen with CAR T-cell therapies in the third line in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. The data from the long-term follow-up of the pivotal ZUMA-1 study showed that high response rates could be achieved and that over 40% of patients 5 years from having CAR T-cell reinfusion were still alive and they were alive, living free of lymphoma. And that data from the pivotal trial in the third line setting has also been mirrored by the data from the real world. And I think it's been characteristic of the data from the real world with CAR T cells in large cell lymphoma is actually that's near mirrored the type of data that we've seen in the pivotal trials. So, of course, that naturally led to the second line trials, where compared with reinduction chemotherapy and autografts, where very many people didn't get to receive the autograft because the reinduction strategy is so poor, that there was both an event, there was an event-free survival advantage in two studies, one looking at axicabtagene, one looking at lysicabtagene, and indeed in the Zuma 7 study, there was an overall survival advantage. The transform study of lysicabtagene won't ever show an overall survival advantage because that's a fact of the statistic. And so very many territories have adopted CAR T-cell in the second line setting for those patients who relapse early. In the UK, we have a very regimented system for approval for second line CAR T-cell therapy. We have a national panel. Every patient needs to be approved by the national panel. It's very strict in the application of the criteria in terms of you can only go into this if you would have been transplant eligible. You have to sign to say I would have transplanted this patient. So when people are talking about transplanting patients in their 75s and 80s, they don't get through panel. And they count the number of days specifically you have been since your last day of induction chemotherapy to 365 days. If you're one day early over when you have that CT scan that demonstrates failure of the disease, you don't get second line CAR T cells. What's interesting is that we're now starting to see real world data of CAR T cell therapy in the second line setting. It's difficult to know if one product has any particular advantages over another. Axicabtagene may be able to provide a rapid turnaround that comes at the expense of much greater toxicity. Lysicabtagene, because of its complex mixture of CD4 and CD8 cells, perhaps their manufacturing might be a little bit slower, but certainly the toxicity profile appears to be a bit more favorable. And of course, you know, associated with CAR T-cell therapies is a unique pattern of toxicity. We recognize not only do we see the cytokine release syndrome and the neurotoxicity, which we've become much better at managing as we've understood these diseases much more. We recognize, however, that there are late toxicities, and those late toxicities are really problematic, and And you go to a lot of meetings and people talk about CAR T cells as a one and done therapy. And I cannot think of an example that's further from the truth. You know, you recognize that these patients have complex problems with cytopenias that go on and require growth factor supports, blood product supports, antibiotics, and this complex B-cell aplasia and the use of immunoglobulin after these patients. So these patients need a lot of aftercare. And I think what's really important is that after CAR T cells, there is a significant excess in non-relapse mortality. And so our attention to looking after these patients is really very important. Delivering CAR T cells is complex. There are very many economic factors. There are very many infrastructure things that we need to think about. We need to think about the individual's socioeconomic consequences of CAR T cell therapy. And so this is not always the right solution for any one individual. And of course, just I'm going to skip over this just in the interest of time. There are a number of problems with failure of CAR T cell therapies. And you'll hear a lot about antigen loss in CAR T cell therapy, and we may hear about a little bit more about this later, and various strategies targeting other antigens in very different ways, with using combination CAR Ts, bicistronic CAR T cells, or tandem T cells. But actually, the problem is not necessarily the loss of antigen, it's actually about the intrinsic problems with the health of the T cells and some of the challenges with T cell senescence and exhaustion, and also importantly around the environment in which the T cells have to work in. And there's a number of ideas to potentially overcome that. So allogeneic CAR T cells may be an approach that may help overcome some of these problems. This provides an off-the-shelf solution with T cells that are already very healthy and can be delivered without some of those constraints that we have in terms of manufacturing. And we're starting to see some of the data looking at allogeneic CAR T cells, which have been engineered to prevent graft versus host disease. We can see the application of these may be potentially very interesting. And of course, there's a lot of talk about in vivo CAR Ts, where you're delivering transfecting your T cells in vivo using a number of different vectors. And I think this has a huge amount of potential because, again, this is going to be an off-the-shelf solution. And in the hematological malignancies, we've begun to see the very first bit of data. This is the data that's been recently published in The Lancet looking at a myeloma, VCMA in vivo CAR T cells, where clearly there's been associated with expansion of T cells, and there's also been clinical responses observed. Now, this is all very interesting. What about your patients who are not fit for some of these intensive regimens? Well, I think there's been a lot of excitement about the regimen of using glofitamab, so a bispecific antibody, in combination with chemotherapy. The STARGLOW data compared glofitamab with the GemOx regimen to R-GemOx chemotherapy. And this study was notable because in transplant ineligible patients, the addition of a bispecific to GemOx chemotherapy was associated with an overall survival advantage. So it wasn't a PFS advantage, it was an overall survival advantage. And I think this is really interesting. You can start to see that there may be potentially a plateau, and how we might apply in the second line setting the application of bispecific antibodies with chemotherapy is going to be really interesting. And perhaps it's going to be dependent upon the first line data in terms of the sequencing. So this is interesting. There's been quite a few challenges in terms of the interpretation of this data. But there's also other trials that have been presented this year, including a randomized study looking at the use of polatuzumab with GemOx chemotherapy in the transplant ineligible patient population, which was associated with an improvement also in overall survival. And so this may be an interesting approach in those territories where first line polatuzumab may not be available. And of course, I think we're all very interested in the combination of polatuzumab with bispecific antibodies. The SUNMO trial looked at the combination of mosunetuzumab with polatuzumab, and this was associated with a very clear improvement in progression-free survival. So for those patients who are ineligible for the sort of more intensive therapies, I think there is some clear excitement on the horizon and some enhanced options for our patients. So going back to my young lad, had relapse, he had an early relapse, he was eligible for CAR T cell, and he was bridged with R-GDP chemotherapy and went on to have axicabtagene. He had axicabtagene in a partial response, he had a very simple post-CAR T cell therapy and was discharged at day 28, well, before day 28, and his PET scan at day 28 demonstrated he'd achieved a second complete metabolic response. So that was great to know. However, unfortunately, just 6 months after having had CAR T cell therapy, he relapsed with nodal disease both above and below the diaphragm. I think it's really important we repeated his biopsy. And I think if we're talking about therapies that are targeting antigens, that we need to make sure that we repeat biopsies to ensure that the antigen is present. So we biopsied him, no change in phenotype, CD20 positivity retained. And in this setting, we were able to use single agent glofitamab. So we do have the choice in the third line setting of being able to use glofitamab or epcoritamab therapy. And I think the data has demonstrated that there are durable responses, high complete metabolic response rates that we can achieve with single agent bispecific antibodies, and they're pretty easy to deliver. And that's the same for epcoritamab. Other choices that we have potentially in the relapse setting is the antibody drug conjugate loncastuximab. This targets CD19. It has a different cytotoxic payload. It's a PPD dimer. This is interesting. It has a distinct pattern of toxicity, including abnormalities of liver function tests and photosensitive rashes. Perhaps it may be less effective in terms of CR rates than bispecific antibodies, but certainly there appears to be some durable responses. And also targeting CD19 is the humanized monoclonal antibody tafasitamab, which we can use in combination with lenalidomide. I think the prospect, however, of using some of these drugs as a single agent perhaps doesn't give us the best scope for future outcomes, and there's some very interesting data about using combination of non-chemotherapy approaches, the VIPER regimen in relapse and refractory disease, which I think, although in a small study, is interesting. We need to wait to see the exploration of these combinations in the future. So just in the last few slides, so my patient at relapse post-CAR T-cell received glofitamab, and glofitamab was delivered really with some grade 1 CRS. We see this in about 60% of patients receiving glofitamab, and he achieved a complete metabolic response rate after 3 cycles. So I continued to give this man 12 full cycles of glofitamab. This is all straightforward. He had some minor infective problems, and he ended his inner CMR at the end of treatment. And I kind of struggled to know, given the pattern of his disease, would a bispecific antibody hold him? what should I do next? And I thought, should I just leave him and trust in the power of the bispecifics? We've seen some really very durable responses with a bispecific antibody. Or should I allograft this patient who's responded to a bispecific antibody? And we pontificated and we talked a lot with him, and we talked a lot as a team and some external discussions, given that this man is now only 24. Should he have an allograft, or should he just trust in the bispecific antibody? Well, in the end, he had a sibling that was matched. And he wanted to go ahead and have an allograft. So he had a lean Campath allograft, and I thought, am I doing the right thing given the long-term follow-up data with glofitamab? He had this. However, on day 16, he developed extensive neck swelling and had a soft tissue infection in his neck. After having had his allograft, he developed airway obstruction, and he crashed on the ward. He went to GICU, and as you know, always happens, once you end up with a tube down, everything goes pear-shaped, and he developed multi-organ failure. And I really beat myself up about this and thought, this man should not have had an allograft. I should have trusted in the power of the T cells. I will say, fortunately, he recovered from his multi-organ failure. He's young and physiologically robust. And here we are later on this year. He's made a good recovery with no GVHD. He's got no evidence of recurrence of lymphoma. But I hope that serves to demonstrate some of the challenges we have in this setting with all of these novel therapies and knowing what to do best. So I think, you know, we've got lots of excitement. We're seeing a very rapid changing landscape. I think the key thing is about precision in patient selection, about preclinical determination of rational combinations, strategies for overcoming resistance, the integration of not just targeting the genomic aberrations in the tumor, but the interaction and the integration with immunotherapy. And what's really important is about reducing toxicity for our patients. Thank you very much for listening.